Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about how we might have better conversations with those who are different from ourselves. In this episode, you will hear a conversation I had with Krista Tippett. Krista is the presenter of the On Being podcast, a Peabody award-winning broadcaster, and a recipient of the President's National Humanities Medal. She was born in Oklahoma, studied history at Brown, and was awarded a Fulbright scholarship, which took her to Germany. She spent several years there working as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times and others in divided Berlin, and then became chief aide to the US ambassador to East Germany. Later, she studied divinity at Yale and began working on a radio project based on religion in the late 1990s. In 2013, she started a non-profit production company, which she describes as a social enterprise with a radio show at its heart, now known as On Being. Its mission is to pursue deep thinking and social courage, moral imagination and joy, to renew inner life, outer life, and life together. We spoke about why she is hopeful about our shared human future, why hope, though, is a muscle we need to exercise, the human fear she sees behind increasing tribalism, and why she thinks the language of God might actually be fruitful in our seemingly secular age. I've learnt an enormous amount from listening to Krista, and I'm sure you will too. Krista, I am so grateful for you talking to me today and have been really looking forward to this. But I realise also have slightly ambushed you because I'm going to kick off, as I try to do, with this really big question. And from reading your work and having the privilege of meeting you previously, I know that you take words really seriously, that you take how we use words, what we mean by concepts as our ways of framing the world really seriously. And the word sacred is used by different people in different places, and it's often associated with religion. But I'm meaning it here really about our deepest values, the things that we want at least to frame and shape our lives, and that we go beyond rationality within us, that no one would be able to give us money to give up, or we'd at least feel some very strong internal resistance to that happening. My thesis is that if we understand that better about ourselves and about others, we might at least be able to have a more honest connection with people who have different sacred values. So having had very little time to think about it, do you know what yours might be?
Does it just have to be one thing?
Not at all. One or two or three is fine.
I mean, honestly, it's such an interesting question and it's such a daunting question. But what comes to mind for me somehow is some combination of a reverence for mystery and complexity, that I acknowledge and honor that in myself and in the world and in others, that we have an inner life. And, you know, to me, you know, kind of my sacred journey, if you will, is it's aspirational. It's creating, you know, a richness and consonance between, you know, interior life and outer presence in the world. But also, if I am attentive to that, to the struggle of that, to, you know, the beauty that comes through that, to the joy that can bring, to the fact that it often makes me aware of my contradictions, then I become attentive to this struggle in others. And I guess at another level that's connected to that, I think there is this strange paradoxical thing about us as creatures that in fact our struggles present the points at which we can also deepen and grow. And again, if I honor that in myself and I honor that in other human beings, whether it's my children or a stranger or my president, I don't know, I'm not sure I want to bring my president to this, but just really just, you know, writ large, the human condition, which is so out on the surface, like I feel like all of our politics now is just the thinnest of veneers over the human drama, then I feel like it opens a possibility kind of moment to moment, you know, on some days more than on others, to really be dealing with what is really real and what is really at stake and what really matters, not just like in news cycle time, but in, you know, in sacred time, in a long view of time, and that the human adventure. I think the human adventure is sacred, and honoring it as such means that I really give myself over to how vast and contradictory it is.
That's an enormous amount to chew on there. When I met you at probably 2 years ago now at the RSA, speaking about your book, Becoming Wise, I was really struck by how hopeful you were, actually. We spoke a lot about the state of public debates and the paucity of wisdom in our common life. And I feel like it's fair, certainly I'm not convinced that 2 years later things have got any better. Are you able to maintain that cautious hopefulness, or, you know, speaking very personally, has that become harder for you?
Well, I've never seen it as a 2 year project, or even I think a 10 year project. So that helps. I mean, I think hope is a muscle. It's a choice, and I choose to move through the world now with, you know, a complicated, which I think is also to say a realistic view of how long, you know, of the kind of the complexity of the moment we're in, of how long the human change that makes social change possible, how long that takes, and to be invested in that. And I do, you know, my work and also what I am looking for does present me, you know, every day with so much beauty in the world, with so many good people, you know, in small places and in as well as in, you know, well, really more like all over the place in all kinds of walks of life and all kinds of situations, you know, creating the new realities that we want our children to inhabit, you know, for the long haul in generational time. In that sense, you know, yes, I remain hopeful. I do see a lot to be hopeful about. And that is not to deny what there is to be despairing about. That is real, too. But I think that the radical move that I make, the muscle I'm building up, is taking as seriously what is often below the radar, what points at our best selves and our best potentials.
I often think that hope takes more courage than despair does, because you're opening yourself up to the possibility of disappointment. And we think of it as a sort of fluffy optimism, but actually the kind of the grit required to keep hoping asks a lot of us.
Yes. And the converse of that is that it's quite an easy, lazy choice to decide to be cynical and hopeless and not invest in any possibility for something better.
Yeah. I think there's just a basic behavioral psychology point there, isn't there, about we know that human beings have an inbuilt tendency to sort of scan the world for threat and for things to be scared of and for things to worry about, and that what's negative will often take up more space in our consciousness than what's positive. What have you found helpful, perhaps in terms of disciplines or practices in helping reset that in yourself, or helping look in Christian terms for, you know, the good, the true, and the beautiful?
Well, you know, that is true. We are hardwired to be riveted by what is frightening, you know, scandalous, destructive, and dangerous. And then what I'm just becoming increasingly aware of in these years is how the way media and journalism have come down to us from the 20th century to now, and the way our technologies have taken that and into a 24/7 news cycle means that, like, that part of us that is alert for danger and for what is wrong and for what we either want to hide from or fight is fed and, you know, is fueled constantly. And it's bad for us. And again, I'm, you know, that's not to say that we don't need to be knowing what is happening, that we don't need to be informed, but there's something really pathological about the way, you know, this profession I love of journalism these days, really just by kind of following old instincts and old ways with new technologies, I think has become destructive to our emotional intelligence, if not to our level of information. So, you know, very practically, I really have had to cut back on how much I'm paying attention to what is on the radar. You know, this notion of breaking news. You know, I think the word breaking there is really revealing, right? So I choose not, you know, in fact, I'll tell you, one of the things I do is that I listen, rather than listening to the morning news here, I listen to the Today program on Radio 4. And the fact that it's, you know, 6 or 7 hours ahead and is not telling me what happened in the last 20 minutes and trying to whip me into it, you know, a sense of frenzy, is very calming because I feel like I still stay up with basically, you know, the themes of the day.
Yeah. Anything major enough happening in the States to be bothered about will be covered by us, but everything else will not.
Right. It's not too enmeshed in the kind of soap opera drama part of what's going on. And so I think, yeah, I honestly think it's a spiritual discipline right now at this moment in our century to get some distance from news and you know, behind that again is, and I just keep repeating this, is not to say that I deny the reality of what is being reported. I don't. But there is a larger story of our time. There's a larger story of us in any given moment, most of which is not reflected in what gets reported as headlines or breaking news or gets tweeted about or covered in a meaningful way. And so the spiritual discipline is deciding to, you know, to use this language of the to use this biblical language, you know, develop eyes to see and ears to hear the fuller story. Yes. What is that language from Philippians? Maybe you're kind of pointing at that, you know, whatever is good, whatever is beautiful, whatever is true, whatever, you know, whatever is honorable, whatever is worthy, think on these things. That's a spiritual discipline to hold that alongside deciding to be engaged and informed and present to the world.
Lots to pick up on there, but I'm going to zoom out a little bit, or perhaps zoom in on the early life of Krista and the things that shaped you and formed you. So what were the religious or spiritual or indeed political and philosophical big ideas in the air as you were running around, you know, in diapers and growing up as a young girl and then a young woman? What do you think were those formative ideas that shaped you?
Grew up in a very small place, a small town in, you know, the middle of our country in Oklahoma, and then kind of moved onto a bigger canvas when I went to college. I really love the way you're asking that question and bringing together the spiritual and the political, the big ideas in the fabric of my world. Because, the truth is, I grew up in a very religious, I grew up in the Bible Belt, as we say here. I grew up in a very religious home. And, you know, we were in church 3 times a week. And church was really the center of, well, honestly, it was the center of social life. It was also the center of intellectual life for me. Like, really, that, you know, it was the Bible was the text I had for having my adolescent quest and my kind of philosophical investigations. And I was that kind of kid. But what I think, and, you know, and this kind of points back to what came to me about your first question about what is sacred. I think the message I imbibed from church as much as politics, and my family was really political, and the world around me was, I don't know how true it was, honestly, to, like, you know, to the essence of Christianity, but certainly this kind of American mid-century, you know, 1960s, 1970s, late 20th century American message about making a difference, but how that was translated and transmitted to me was in having a big external life. It wasn't really about inner virtue. You know, even though we talked about that, but that's not really what it was about. I mean, those things were stepping stones to succeeding in a certain way. And, you know, I think this is all this legacy we have in the West. Or, you know, it's Max Weber. It's like how we turned the Protestant ethic into a work ethic. And I very much inherited that. And honestly, I think about this a lot these days because I think we've now come full circle with how bad that emphasis on exterior accomplishment, on big external life, on and the metrics of success for that, which would be, you know, money, celebrity, power. you know, we now in this country, those things are kind of, you know, and it's not really on one side of the political spectrum or the other. It's like the, we now have kind of a caricature of that kind of leading us, and we see how insufficient it is that we haven't celebrated and rewarded these other kinds of more reflective qualities, and, you know, people who join inner life with outer presence in the world. And I do see that I'm very aware of that inheritance in me. And I think, you know, I kind of started walking away from that at some point. And I see emerging generations walking away from that because it's a very lonely and ultimately unfulfilling way to live. But unfortunately, it is a way of life that we've privileged. And now we are kind of, you know, reaping the fruits of that.
Some hopefulness that the general sense of dissatisfaction with that lie that we've been sold about what helps us flourish might fade. Although, you know, this is and not just in the Bible, everywhere you look, really, where you have significant lasting ethical teaching says, you know, what use is it to gain the whole world and lose your soul? You know, don't build up treasures on earth. The warnings against building our lives on the wrong things rather than relationship with God and relationship with others in Christian terms have been there, and yet that pull towards short-term pleasure, short-term satisfaction, affirmation from the outside seems a very difficult thing to overcome. In the UK, we have kind of secular communities like Sunday Assembly, congregations and others, and Caspar Tikal, who you is working with you on Being is Brilliant, and others really seeking to see what does it mean, because actually knowing the science that well-being is predicated primarily on lives full of meaning and purpose and lives full of significant relationships, you know, and health and some freedom. They're not the only things, but they're very central. Knowing that and then actually being able to build it and sustain it and make the kind of hard choices that go against the narratives that we're being fed over a lifetime requires an enormous amount of us. And society's not currently set up with structures to help us. We don't have the scaffolding. I see a bit of scaffolding, or perhaps some experiments in scaffolding building in what you're doing in On Being. So for listeners who don't know, could you say a little bit about what On Being perhaps was and now is, and what you hope it to be?
Started as a public radio show and is now also a podcast because podcasting is the evolution of radio. And it's, you know, it's a big conversation that I've been having for, you know, 18 years about the religious and spiritual aspect of life, about moral imagination, about wisdom. You know, I think, Elizabeth, you used the word flourishing, right? And I think, you know, that is just such an important, you know, the shift from succeeding to flourishing. And as you say, like, what is involved, even and especially what our frontiers of science are teaching us about that, is what our spiritual traditions have taught us about this, the fullness of us. I mean, I think we have this capacity to reimagine and live into human wholeness on a whole new level this century if we manage to survive and not self-destruct. And I think that what On Being, you know, as I think about it now at this remove of years, it's, you know, I say I've really been interested in the great ancient enduring questions that gave rise to our religious traditions, but are also just universal human questions. You know, what does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? And in this century, inextricable from that, who will we be to each other? So this has been this ongoing conversation. And I think I have looked for voices of wisdom as opposed to mere success, and people who have something, who are, whether they are physicists or biologists or theologians or spiritual teachers or poets, who have something to teach us, some wisdom to impart, something to teach us about how flourishing happens, how it can work, you know, both in terms of, you know, with a robust life of the mind, but also very practically in the context of, you know, the raw materials of the lives we are given.
We're just going to take a short break to catch up with the Theos team.
Thank you.
I'm here in the office with Nick Spencer, and Nick has been reading and reviewing a new book about the effects of inequality on our internal worlds. What is it, Nick?
It's called The Inner Level by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. They're, I think, social epidemiologists. And it's a follow-up from their mega bestseller from 10 years ago called The Spirit Level, which looked at how inequality shapes society or misshapes society. This one's about how inequality misshapes the soul, if you like. That's not a word they use, but I can substitute it.
Tell me, just for those who didn't know The Spirit Level, what was the argument of that and how controversial was it?
Level marshalled the vast range of data to show that societies that are more unequal economically, materially unequal, have much higher levels of, and then you can choose your kind of your social ill there, whether it's kind of lower levels of longevity or high levels of infant mortality or high levels of crime or whatever.
And even things like teenage pregnancy from memory.
Yes, I mean, a very wide range of things. It was controversial and a lot of people criticised it, and some people did pick apart some of the data. They tended to do so because the art book was arguing very strongly against free market capitalism, effectively laying all the sins of modern societies at its door. Free market capitalists didn't like that very much, so there was a bit of a hoo-ha. But I interviewed the authors at their publishers a couple of weeks ago, and you know, they were absolutely at pains to emphasize, as they did many times after the publication of The Spirit Level, that it's very, very data heavy. So even if you can pick apart some of the data points, if you like, the picture remains pretty robust.
And The Inner Level is building on that work. What are its key conclusions?
Well, if you like, if you've read The Spirit Level, or even if you're familiar with The Spirit Level, you'll know where The Inner Level is coming from, or rather where it's going to. So imagine questions of mental health or anxiety or depression, these kind of things of which we hear a great deal nowadays. Their argument is that inequality in society, as it were, doesn't just affect things out there, but it affects things in here as well, to do with the state of our emotions and our psychological well-being. And again, they marshal quite a lot of information, not as much as the previous book, but quite a lot. They emphasise that a lot of the studies weren't there 10 years ago, and this is all a developing field. But again, they make a pretty cogent case for it.
And were you persuaded?
Up to a point, I was. I have some reservations, and I pushed them in an interview about to what extent equality or other inequality is causal here rather than correlative. So is inequality causing all these things that are just correlated with them? Now, actually, I think it's pretty causal, but I would hesitate before laying quite as much at the door of inequality as they do. It seems to me that there isn't a social or indeed psychological ill that can't be laid at the door of inequality. Well, I suspect it's actually slightly more complex than that. Inequality is tied in with the social and psychological ills, but it's one factor alongside others.
And from your political theology or social theology hat, is there something that you think they might be missing drawing on that tradition?
The disappointing thing about the book is it's a religion-free zone almost entirely. Now, in one sense, that's not a fair criticism. That's not their subject. But when they talk about the real problem here is a lack of an anchored sense of the self. It's a lack of proper relational wholeness. It's a lack of proper company, company coming from Latin with bread. Sharing bread with people. There's a bit of an open goal there, and I'm going to be writing a bit more about this for the Theos website, you know, in a few weeks, I hope. But there is a very long-standing tradition of Christian and indeed other faith traditions that talk specifically about this issue, about if you pin your value, if you pin your worth, yourself, to external, fluid, contingent, vulnerable qualities, how you look, how much you own, where you go on a holiday, all these kind of things, you will end up eroding that sense of self, that sense of security. And I think the book would have been stronger had it acknowledged that they were speaking into a very long-standing debate rather than generating it afresh.
Nick, thank you for speaking to me.
Now back to our conversation.
I wanted to ask particularly about, well, we'll come on to talk about tribalism in more detail, but one of the things I was pondering as I was reading through some articles on the On Being website and as I listen is, how do you internally as an organisation think about tribalism and how to model what you do in a way that crosses boundaries? And I say this because I feel like the voices I hear on Being are diverse in lots of ways, but maybe because so many of them are coming from social justice traditions and campaigners and artists, it feels like the center of gravity is slightly more progressive than otherwise. And I wanted to just reflect that back to you and say, does that feel right? Does that feel okay? And how easy do you find it to bridge and find those voices of wisdom who are coming from a more conservative or whatever word you want to call, you know, other ends of the political spectrum?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's something I think about a lot. I'm not all that interested in the center or like what the center might be. I'm not sure a center exists. But I think that one thing I'll say about both people who are on the show and people who are part of this kind of listening community, I think our people are bridge people. I think that also is a spiritual calling for the 21st century, and that is to be planted someplace. That's not to not have an identity and not to not have strong convictions and passions, but to in some ways to be so firm, so at home in those, but also with a maturity that you are still, you know, you're carrying questions alongside your answers, and you're interested in the questions of others and able to kind of, you know, step beyond the tribal boundaries of, you know, whatever your group is or your convictions, to have some curiosity, if not empathy, but even curiosity will take us so far. And it's in short supply, you know, at least in our official spaces. I guess, you know, one thing I think about one thing we know about our audience is that there is it's a wonderful spectrum of humanity. And it does cross that progressive conservative divide. And I love having, like, in our media space, people together in this media space thinking about meaning who are not necessarily finding themselves together in physical spaces right now. I guess one thing we had a gathering earlier this year and that this, you know, a version of this question came up about, it sounds like there's a progressive, you know, sensibility to this overall. And I guess one thing I push because, and what they were talking about, yeah, is that we are, there's an assumption that we are all invested in, interested in, and want to be invested in social healing, for example. And I guess I'm very careful with language of not using catchwords. I don't know, I think even justice is a word that, I mean, a lot of our best words are politicized. And I think if you can use language generously and frame even what have been very fraught conversations, like, you know, frame them hospitably and carefully in order to and vividly as well. I kind of push against the idea that, you know, something like social healing, and again, you hear me, I'm not using the language of social justice, just because the language itself is a bit hijacked. But see, I actually think there are more of us together in this space of longing for that. Just say that, longing for that, you know, maybe with a great range of understandings of how one goes about working for that and what it looks like. But I think we have a lot of shared questions that absolutely robustly cross that liberal conservative divide. And so what I'm trying to do, and I certainly think you're probably right also because our base is on public radio, right? So I certainly think that we started out with many more progressives in this boat. But I think what I'm knowing about our people is that this is, I think, this growing number of us, and it crosses right to left, which is always such a simplification, right? But it crosses right to left of those of us who are just fed up, who do not want to participate in this tribalism, and who have some questions in common, even if we are not sure, you know, what would happen if we pit our answers against each other. So, I mean, this is a work in progress, and we're just feeling our way. There's something.
I ask really because we're trying to learn from you because, you know, the think tank environment in the UK, as there, I'm sure, is highly politically polarized, and we're working very hard and very committed to not being co-opted by either end of the political spectrum, because we feel like Christian wisdom and religious wisdom more generally, where it has enormous amount to offer for the common good, cuts across those. And when we allow particularly, you know, Christian political involvement doesn't have a great track record, right? It's very easy for it to go very wrong.
Well, although there is William Wilberforce, right? I mean, if you look at it in a long enough span of time, there's hospitals and universities that we can credit to Christianity.
Thanks, Krista. You made the point I should have made. but I think there's a sense in which, well, we internally at the Theos team are trying to reflect a lot on our own tribalism and where are we unconsciously making certain groups feel welcome and certain groups feel not welcome, and about the language that we use. And I see that happening in On Being. So it was to try and hear you think out loud a bit about that, and that has been really helpful. Let's move on then for a short time, because no one really wants to think about it for too long. The state of the public conversations, particularly in the US. And I'd love to hear, I'll start with, I interviewed a guy called Andy Crouch, who is a US evangelical, very, very thoughtful guy. And I came to him with this thesis, which was that what you're seeing in the US is this clash of sacred values around kind of commitment to equality and individual liberty on one hand, and this deeply held sacred value about the human person and life, and particularly the life of the fetus. And, you know, when that sacred value around limiting abortion, you know, if that was held deeply and sacredly enough, it made lots of other things justifiable. And he said, no, I don't think that's what's happening at all, which is always helpful. And he said, I think there's something much more instinctive and much less principled going on, which is the deep human need for affirmation. And he spoke about how what Trump is good at is making his base feel seen and affirmed. And he told the story of, I believe, Nixon going to a conference of Christian broadcasters right in those early days when the religious right was on the rise, and saying, you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. And something about making people who have felt perhaps disconnected from the center seen and affirmed as being what is driving some of that energy behind what looks like to many of us deeply, deeply unsettling policies that are counter to the common good, which is a very long-winded way of saying I'd love to hear your reflections on what is driving this increasing polarization in the States.
Yeah, I think what I will say is putting different words to that. What I think it's about is, you know, I wouldn't even say simple. I would say it's primal, right? It's fear. It's human fear. It's human hope. It's the death of dreams. It's dreams that are just being born. And it's all of these things clashing. But we don't, you know, we don't create space for that to be. I mean, I think this is also true of the Brexit phenomenon in the UK, right? Like, pain and fear and a feeling of having been left out is not what we talk about. We turn that into politically respectable expressions like outrage and hatred, and we wield votes rather than actually acknowledging and dealing with each other at this human level of what's actually going on and fueling all of those things. Politics, you know, I think I said this a minute ago, is just this. I think that it's always been about the human drama. And in a moment like this, that is just absolutely all out on the surface. And still, what we don't know how to do, and this is kind of the work I'm doing and the work you're doing, is let's find a vocabulary and let's create trustworthy spaces. Those trustworthy spaces are not going to be in our halls of parliament. It's not going to be in political discourse right now. But we can create trustworthy spaces to talk about the real underlying human dimensions at play here. And the other thing I would just say, which I think will be very hard for anybody in the UK to see, and is also like hard for Americans to see, certainly the progressive side of the American spectrum. You know, there's some new there's this puzzlement on the progressive side of things in the U.S. that, and I'm sure in where you are, that you know, Trump supporters, as they are lumped together, which is right there part of the problem, but Trump supporters don't betray him en masse. There's something about Donald Trump that, you know, that people appreciate, and now there's research coming up about this, that he is authentic in a completely terrifying and unattractive way, depending on where you sit. But he has opted out of the game of politics as it has been played, and as we had kind of gotten used to, and a game that in fact increasingly had left a lot of people out, and yet had this incredible sense of self-righteous, being on the right side of history. And, you know, he says what he thinks, and, you know, the fact that what he thinks may contradict itself from one day to the next is not the point. People feel like he's a straight shooter, and there is a sense in which his popularity is not about him at all, although that feels really illogical to people, and it is, but none of us is acting as logical creatures right now. He is opting out. He's breaking all the rules. And there's a sense in which, you know, playing by the rules had been failing so many people. It's just, you know, it's messy. It is so messy. And really, I am very, like, in my work and in my personal well-being, I am not invested. I'm not, like, expecting the next election cycle to solve this or the one after that. I'm talking to people who've been involved in social transformation, and it's generational. And I really do see the people who I think can lead us with an entirely new paradigm kind of 20 years from now. And I'm interested in befriending and nurturing those people. I mean, this is a real culture shift moment, right? This, we are turn of century people.
Gosh, it's so encouraging talking to you. I feel better already. I wanted to talk about one particular specific thing because I really feel conflicted and I would value your wisdom on it. But funnily enough, it's something that's going on in American politics at the moment. And the fact that you didn't know exactly what happened is testament to the fact that you're actually doing a really good job at putting in boundaries for what you consume. And I realized, I don't even know when it happened. It probably was only about 48 hours ago. But an incident in which Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked to leave a restaurant by the manager has kicked off, as far as I can see at a distance, the debate about this word civility. And I really hate the word civility. And I think it's just because it sounds a bit snooty. In my head, it's like civility, Sybil, civility. And it doesn't speak to me of anything of grace, empathy, or kind of radical commitment to the other, which is much more familiar in terms of my thinking about how we engage with people who drive off absolutely bonkers and we'd much rather wallop in the face than civility does. But for some reason in the States, that's the vocabulary that has been settled on. You know, are you civil or are you prepared to stand up against injustice? And how far should, you know, what's the line in which someone no longer deserves civility and you're just colluding with power? And is it used to exclude minority voices? So my question really was, should that manager have served Sarah Huckabee Sanders? And more broadly, is the language of civility useful or helpful?
Yeah, I mean, I realize this, the word civility is pretty ruined. I mean, even before this, it was ruined, right? It has this connotation of being nice and tame and polite. And certainly, you know, those are not qualities that meet the severity of this moment. I mean, I also think that civility is not a word we want to lose. You know, I think some words we let go of or we stop using them as much for a while. I think others we kind of have to try to salvage. And I always use words like, I just talk about muscular civility or civility as an adventure, you know, the adventure of civility. But I don't want to get too invested in that discussion. I think that is a distraction. The real question is how social change happens, right? I mean, I feel like the real question, certainly liberals and progressives should be asking, is how to make a difference, like how to And then just to start examining how they're asking that question, right? Because if the question is how to get these stupid people to see sense, because that's really the way, whether the question is, and it's often phrased that way. Okay, no human being in history anywhere, like I feel absolutely confident in this sweeping statement. No human being in history has ever changed because someone else told them they're stupid, ever. So if what we really care about is not getting our outrage, however justified, off our chest, if what we really care about is addressing the fracture and the chasms between us and our fellow citizens with whom we must build the world that our children together inhabit, right? We don't actually have a choice about that. We do not have a possibility of meeting, you know, the huge challenges of this century, like how we're going to, you know, right size our relationship to the natural world, you know, for starters, or deal with something like refugee crisis. I mean, there's so many things that we actually have to be working together on to address in their enormity. And so the thing I wish there were not arguments and posturing about, but real reflection and discernment and searching, perhaps at the cost of always sounding, of always getting your point across and sounding right, which in fact has shut off a conversation that needs to happen. That's where I wish we were spending our energy.
Extremely helpful and also extremely difficult in the sense of the urgency of dealing with this current awful thing. I fear we are going to have to draw this to a close because your time is very precious, but I want to ask one final question, which is, well, two-part question, cheating, which is, and you've indicated some possible answer to this, what would be the one thing that would might help us build better relationships across difference that people could practically implement in their lives? And secondly, with particular regard, I think, to religion, is there something that religious people should bear in mind when they're speaking in public that might help them build those relationships across difference rather than sometimes, I think, unconsciously alienating others?
Yeah, I mean, on the first question, I think we could instantaneously shift the energy and create new openings if we decided that we were going to start our conversations not with our positions, if we actually tabled our answers and positions and arguments and brought our questions to each other, brought our hopes and fears, like said, what we're going to articulate now is not like how I feel about this issue or what my argument is, or but what are the hopes and fears I bring? What is behind the ferocity of my argument, right? What are the hopes and fears I bring to this and share that with each other? And then I think, you know, I'm not all about getting lost in touchy-feely. That's not what I am. But I think we have to create new departure points so that we get out of these well-worn ruts. There's so many conversations that start these days that we could all absolutely write the script about what's going to happen next. It's actually just not a good use of our time. So that's one thing. And then, yes, with religious people, I think I'm so clear that, you know, we were talking earlier we've talked about this whole time. Like, I think, you know, it's intriguing to me. There are some words as we've been discussing that are kind of ruined, that are too fraught there. But then there are words that are rising up, as something people are really, it's like meeting longings people didn't know they have. And, you know, like a language that I'm finding to be very magnetic, certainly to younger people, to new generations, you know, the language of virtue, the language of moral imagination, the language of love. And again, I'm going to, you know, muscular love, something like this, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about what we need is a strong, demanding love. He said, I'm not talking about emotional bosh. So what can that look like in public? So I think what that also says to me, what I know is that a lot of the language and the conversation across generations and the very words themselves and the deep lineage of practice of something like virtue and love, and even the language of God, I find, is like raising up. People are kind of understanding, like, whether they believe in God or not, we need that language to point at something beyond us. And so I think Christians can be very, and religious people can be actually quite, you know, planted, and I want to say more richly planted in this ground, and you know, step into that space, but as a conversation, right? Not as a sermon, not as judgment, but understand that there's this interesting, you know, we live in just, it's such a both and moment. You know, on the one hand, all of our discussions are primal and shut down. And at the same time, there's, you know, we just did a show last week, actually, with a British with a literary historian, Lindsay Stonebridge, on what Hannah Arendt might have to say for us now. And we have had this incredible response to that show from very unexpected places. So what I always see is, you know, it's always a both and. So there's also this opening to think big and to think deep. And in a moment like this, you know, those of us who have a theological vocabulary, who are part of that lineage, like that there is a longing for that, and that is absolutely, there's a sense in which the conversation for that, the opening to that, is more ripe than ever before. So it's a very interesting and promising moment, and I think also just, but the other thing is just for all of us. I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but all of this is true. Like when we use the words, that the words that are most meaningful to us, you know, that most point at goodness and beauty and truth and what is sacred, we cannot assume that they land in another person's mind with all those connotations that we have. So that even as we revive the words and the experience behind them, the meaning behind them, that is most that we find most urgent and is an offering from our deepest places to the world's deepest places, we also always have to keep surrounding our use of that word with practice, you know, with embodying what we're talking about, and also with an ecosystem of other words that invites other people in to the richness of the meaning it has for us.
So building on that, I'm really glad that you brought up what I sometimes call the G-bomb, i.e. the God word, because I had a great conversation with an atheist who said that whenever she makes programs about faith, she's one of the things she does, she makes radio programs, she's always surprised at how few religious people talk about God. And we just recorded a podcast and went to the pub, and she said, "You promised me that you were going to talk about God." And I realized that I was trying to explain to her why it's difficult for religious people to talk about God in public. And I said, part of it is a kind of Rawlsian rules of the public square that says when you come into public, you must bring public reason and you must give explanations that everyone can understand. So there's a sense of an illegitimacy about talking about God in public. And then I said, and deeper than that, there is an immense emotional vulnerability about talking about God for both parties, because the person who believes in God is opening up something that feels very personal and relational and intimate. And I said, it's a bit like, you know, if I talk about believing in God and someone immediately wants to tell me why God doesn't exist, it's like trying to tell me that my mum doesn't exist. You know, it's not a philosophical, abstract, academic exercise for me. It's more personal than that. And then perhaps for the person who doesn't believe in God, they might feel threatened by that idea or worried about what it means, because it's such a capacious term that can mean anything. And then maybe they've got some history with it and some disappointment, or it's always an emotionally loaded term, right? It's always going to trigger something. And that's why I think religious people, and sometimes even us at Theos, feel nervous about throwing the G-bomb into a conversation because of all of that kind of psychological firestorm that it can trigger with everyone in the room. So I wanted to ask, really, how do you manage that on being and not skirt around it as a central element to a lot of people's spirituality, whilst holding the space for those who don't feel that language reflects where they are?
Yeah, and you know, there's that is baggage from actual ways in which in which the language and of God and representatives of God have not always done good, to put it mildly. You know, here's what I know. It's not like we use the word God all the time, and I also, you know, have a reverence for that language, and so you don't use it all the time. You don't use it lightly. But what my experience is that when someone speaks in a real way out of their experience, you know, and I, you know, the people I'm speaking with are always joining the life of the mind with the life in this world, that is interesting and intriguing to others, even if they don't share that belief and it's honorable, and it adds to their sense of, you know, what it means to be human and what it means to be alive and of reality. I mean, I'm also just really aware of a couple of things that are context for me in this question of talking about God. We in our countries have made a God of the market, right? We don't use the language of God, but we bow down at the altar of the market and its metrics, and it has been so bad for us. So I think, and you know, Alain de Botton has said this, right? Like, you know, it's not like we created morality-free zones when we took the language of God and prayer out of the public square. We have filled it with commercial messaging, which demeans us. And so I think that sense that so many of us have, and certainly our kids have, that this is not a way to live, that this can't define us, it opens this space for us to actually to work with this word, and for those of us who have this belief and can put words around it, to offer that. Now, I think what's the shift from now to the way it was done badly is it's not, you know, there was so much talk about God damning you, right? I mean, God was this judgmental, terrifying figure, and those people speaking about God in that way were putting themselves in the seat of God. I think the conversation that's possible now is very different. I'm also really mindful of, Einstein used the language of God a lot. Einstein was not a religious person in any traditional sense, but he would say, "What I want to know is whether God had to." You know, he talked about the mind behind the universe. I feel like even and especially on our scientific frontiers, you know, whether we might be talking about the laws of physics is really, I don't think we can resolve that or need to worry about that too much. I feel like there's so many ways for us to, with integrity, you know, we're always, all of us are reaching, the most theologically educated person is also trying to define something that is beyond our comprehension. And so if we acknowledge that, if we use this word with that humility, with that sense that it points at a mystery, even for the most devout of us, we can't use this language. If this language helps us point beyond ourselves, it helps us point at undergirding truths, and it helps us move beyond this terrible tendency we have as human beings to worship things that demean us. Right. So I think reasserting that language is also a way to push back against that. And that is absolutely one of the great challenges of modernity.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. Our producer is Hussein Kezvani, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd love to hear what you think. Please do get in touch via Twitter at @sacred_podcast or sacredpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what you loved, what you hated, and who you think we should talk to next. We'd also be really grateful if you'd rate and review us wherever you get your podcast, and spread the word to your friends. Thanks very much.